Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service. Because nobody likes waiting around. You listening, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy. It's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Well, hello and welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Just basically coming out of your coming out of my mouth into your ears, I guess is the correct term of phrase. But anyway, we have been spoiling you on Soundtracking recently with so many wonderful bonus episodes, and we've got another one for you today in the shape of the legend, the wonderful, entertaining and hugely talented individual that is Steve McQueen. Steve joined me in front of an audience at Screen on the Green in Islington in London as part of our Soundtracking Everyman Film Club to discuss his new film Blitz, which is out in cinemas now. It stars Saoirse Ronan, Paul Weller, Kathy Burke, a 9-year-old Elliot Hefferman, amongst others, in his first acting role. And the film follows a defiant young boy who goes on a bit of an adventure during World War II, only to find himself in mortal peril amid the Blitz while his mum searches for him. Now, music is such a key part to the film, both kind of diegetically, so within the narrative, but also, beautiful score. So Steve's worked with Hans Zimmer, Nicholas Britell, and a few other kind of surprise guests that feature on specific tracks. But we'll begin with Hans's cue, Somewhere to Shelter.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh. Congratulations. It's a bloody great film again. So great. It's so interesting. I think the first thing I said to someone when I came out from seeing it the first time was like, you know, it's an era that we've seen on screen so many times and a time in our history that we feel we know everything about, yet you've told us something completely different, something that's completely, doesn't feel like it's been seen on screen before. Was that the intention, to show the unknown of an era gone by but that still has relevance to us now?
I just started with a young boy. Started with this photograph of a little boy I found when I was doing research for Small Axe. And I saw this photograph of this black boy, this child. Obviously, you know, one parent would have been white, one parent would have been black, and he had a cap on his head and he had a little suitcase. And I just wanted to save him. I knew he was in danger. Even though he's going to be evacuated, I didn't know what he would encounter. And from that moment, it was a case of making a picture about his sort of journey. But then again, after I sort of got to some point, I thought, yes, seeing war through a child's eyes, that could be it. And I think also, what also got me was the perspective of the camera. Oh, we put the camera down there. So if the camera's down there, everything becomes 3 times as big. From his perspective, and that, I thought, okay, that's interesting. That's an interesting way in.
And there are elements in the film which I was so fascinated to read about that are there are real people, there are real stories within that film as well. Do you mind talking a little bit about navigating that journey as a, you know, as wanting to create a story that embraces real people, real situations, but also you're creating the story, so you're almost bringing them along for the ride in a way.
I think doing the research for Small Axe was very, very helpful, and also the research on Occupy City as well. There's lots of, you know, again, fact is stranger than fiction, and you know, coming across people like Mickey Davis, I mean, how the hell do we not know who Mickey Davis is? How the hell do we not know who he is? You know, he was one of the architects of the National Health Service. I mean, what a man. I mean, I kind of knew this, but a lot of people didn't. That, you know, imagine a lot of people here don't. That, you know, Churchill prevented people from hiding in the underground because apparently he said he didn't want people to cower. And the people who actually wanted to go in the underground, told people about the underground, were the people who, you know, left the UK to fight, you know, the fascists in Spain and Franco. And they knew about the subways in Madrid. So again, all of these things tie into so many sort of things and finding things out. You know, I've got the Cafe Paris and, you know, living life of Riley, you know, there's rations going on. There's a war going on, but obviously in that environment, there's a different kind of thing going on. A different kind, I would say, thing going on. One could say criminality compared to how other people are living.
Benjamin Clementine's character is based on real person as well?
Benjamin, I met Benjamin about 8 years ago. And I thought, oh, we'll have to make a movie with you. And then my mum touched his cheekbones. Where'd you get those? Mum! I've never seen my mum touch a man's. I was like, dude, what's going on? Leave him alone. Embarrassing. Anyway, moving on. But now Benjamin Clementine character Ife, Love, is based on a guy called Ite Epion, who was a law student from Nigeria, and on the outbreak of war, he became an air raid warden. And that scene in the shelter was true. That speech actually happened when people were trying to divide people from each other. So that speech they gave is true.
It's not a question I ask often, but when it comes to research, you know, all these people and stories and conversations that you've discovered through your research, it's such an important part to your journey as a storyteller and a filmmaker.
Yeah, because again, a lot of this thing happened from research from the Imperial War Museum, as well as from a gentleman called Joshua Levine, who wrote a wonderful book called The Secret History of the Blitz. It's important. Life is much more interesting and complex and fascinating and revealing and life affirming than is given to believe, you know.
Your cast in this is amazing. Can I just commend you for getting Kathy Burke back on the big screen?
Oh. That was a task. She wasn't having her and Paul weren't having it. But yeah. Couple more cups of tea. It'll be all right. Yeah.
But so many brilliant, brilliant people who just bring these characters to life. I mean, Saoirse, for example.
Oh, my God.
Saoirse. And that relationship she has with Elliot.
You know, I wasn't thinking of Saoirse when I wrote it. But she had a really good agent because the agent had the script. What the hell? I was like, wow, what a great agent you got. And I thought, oh, yeah, Saoirse. So she wrote it. Okay, that's good. She was in Australia doing a movie at the time. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to her and she was talking about her mother. She had a very close relationship with her. It's just her and her mother. Tight. You know, the mother and daughter, but also friends, best of friends. And it was beautiful. And then when she told me about that, I thought, okay, you would understand that relationship with George. Then, of course, the big question happened was, can you sing? And she said to me, I can hold a tune. Oh, bloody hell, what does that mean? But what was interesting about it, we got her a singing coach in Australia. And I never forget the call I got from a singing coach after she trained with her and whatnot for a number of days. She goes, not only can she sing, it's only going to get better. And I was so happy. She had a voice. I mean, that was amazing. So moving on with Elliot, of course, you write the script. Okay, this is not bad. Oh, bloody hell. George, does he exist? Does this child exist? So there's a lady called Nina Gold, a great cast director, threw a net large and wide to find, you know, this person. And then I saw a tape of this kid who looked really pissed off, like he didn't want to be there. But at the same time, he was so magnetizing, his face. So you leaned in and like, you looked here, you looked there, you wanted to know what he was thinking, or you thought you knew what he was thinking. And then somehow, at a certain point, he kind of reflected you. He was a proper child, you know. He wasn't a child actor, he wasn't a child pretending to be a child, you know what I mean? He was like that, and you see it in the movie, that depth, that gravitas. So when I brought him on, I told him he had the part on his 9th birthday. He was 8 when he auditioned. And then Saoirse came along and she kind of, you know, she took him under her wing, and that sort of care was reciprocated, this affection. And they just got on a house on fire, this love. And again, I don't know that word is, but there's a real affection and a real what can I say, a relationship there, which obviously you saw on screen. Which you listen, this was the most important thing in the picture for me. You know, stunts, or you know, big special effects, big sequences. You know, just shoot it again. We don't got to shoot it again. But that you cannot fake. That you cannot sort of. It's gold dust if you have that. And also, when you have that, then you can build your foundation on top of that.
Was she not about the same age when she started acting?
She was 9 years old, yeah.
Wow. Because that scene where she goes, like, play the drums. That whole, I love that scene. And then when she picks the eyelash. Yeah.
Well, that's all improvised.
No!
Yeah, I did. Again, you know, when you write, I'm not a comic strip writer, you know, a cartoonist, or, you know, again, scripts are there to get the money, and then you move on. There's their starting point, and then that's it. So because I sort of caught my eye them doing that. Oh, do that again. The eyelash, but of course it became huge in the picture. But that was just them improvising it.
When you're talking about Elliot, about kind of his face, that scene in the train where he's just staring, and I don't think I took a breath for that entire, because you just can't. It's almost like hypnotic. He's got such a presence in that. For a young 9 years old, that's absolutely incredible. What a performance.
Yeah, he's real. He's real. Listen, what was so amazing about Elliot was the concentration, and he took direction. Mm. I mean, the concentration was scary. Mm. But because it for him, it was real.
Yeah.
It lifted everyone's game. So it was real for him. He's a child, you know. He's never acted before. He doesn't know what acting is. He ignored the camera. And then he's there. Done.
And then Weller. Paul Weller.
Yeah, Paul.
I mean, bloody hell.
He wasn't too keen at the beginning, but yeah.
How did you persuade him?
I think, you really think so? I can't, no, don't do a Paul Weller accent, you twat. Oh, I did start. Can't, moving on. No, he was really, again, no, I needed someone who had sort of an authenticity and a weight and a gravitas. I needed it.
In music as well.
Yeah, in yes, absolutely. You knew that it was the real deal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But someone also, his personality, Paul is an extremely sweet man. And I don't mean that in his, he's extremely generous. Because you have a six-year-old man, a 29-year-old woman, and a 9-year-old child. And in that group, it was like they knew each other forever. Because how Paul interacted with them is so generous and so affectionate, and it was they loved being together. So for me, it was like, oh, is it in focus? Action, let's just shoot it. I mean, they loved being together, and there was no hierarchy because of age or anything like that. Everyone was, you know, giving and taking and listening. And of course, as Paul's a musician, you know, he listens and when to intervene and when to come out. But also, you know, Paul was interesting in so many ways. I mean, you know, Paul has two black children, you know, his first two children. Two children he knows about. Mm-hmm. So when he's walking away to be evacuated, you see Gerald's face, Paul's the character's face. He knows what could happen to them. He knows what the dangers are in the broader, wider world out there. So it's important that you have this sort of reality to a situation. I mean, you know, it's proper.
Yeah, music. There is so much wonderful music in the film, and it takes lots of different kind of forms and. Paul, for example, when we see him at the piano, and original songs that have been written for the
Nicholas Britell,
who you've worked with in the past. Yeah. And talk to me a little bit about that journey, you know, because that's all got to be done before you start shooting, so that they can practice and they can learn those songs. But you wrote lyrics for
with Nicholas Britell. Winter's Coat. So my dad, when he died 18 years ago, left me. Actually, 19 years ago I was at his grave today by coincidence. So 19 years ago, I thought it was 18, 19 years ago, and he left me his winter coat. I thought, okay, I love the idea of you when you put an absence and presence, when you put on a coat, it's like a hug, it's like an embrace. And it's like, you know, the cold and the warmth of that person. I thought any and everybody could relate to that, especially when Serge was singing to the audience, singing to the factory, that everyone in that audience is thinking of a father or a brother or an uncle or whoever, you know, person who's not there.
Turn up my collar, whatever the weather, you'll be with me. Wherever I go, we'll be together, just you and me. I wrap myself in a warm, sunny you, not to feel blue.
Anyone who's had a situation of grief as this kind of keepsake. So the physicality of that, but also I love the idea of a hug, and it's cold and it's warm with this person's. Yeah, and Nicholas was fantastic. Nicholas Patel was fantastic about that, because we wrote originally. He wrote original songs for that. I co-wrote that with the one and him, but because it was always about tomorrow be better. You know, we wrote a song called Brighter Days. He wrote a song called Brighter Days. It was about tomorrow. It was always about down the road. It's going to be okay. Now it's not necessarily. You know, it's not so great, but tomorrow. So the whole idea of writing original songs was if you got people to ring songs that we know, it would take you out of the picture. Mm. So to put you, obviously, to plant it into what you're observing, one needed to sort of, write original songs.
This shall not be the end, sunshine's long overdue. Fare thee well for now, brighter days soon. Maybe this is the sign to hang upon thy dear heart. Lift thine eyes toward mine, I'm coming home to you. Hold thy light through the night, find your way back ashore.
Side of that, you've got Hans doing the score as
dynamic
well.
Dynamic duo, Nicholas Brutel and Hans Zimmer. So Hans, oh my God! So Hans, I worked with him on Widows, and then we hear the conversation. Worked with him 12 years on Widows, and the dynamic duo of Nicholas Brutel and Hans worked with him for 12 years. So I wanted them back. I remember Hans telling me a story, and when we did Widows, that his mother was evacuated from Germany to London. And she lived here during the Blitz. She lived in Mayfair on the top of a building during the Blitz. 5 years later, immediately when the war finished, she went back to Germany and worked as a translator. And there she basically married Hans's father. 5 years later, unfortunately, when Hans was 5 years old, he died. And Hans went to boarding school. So I showed Hans the movie with obviously Anim's music and his score, and he said, "Miraculous, I know exactly what to do." Because those things were in him for such a long time. And I actually told him beforehand, before I asked him to do it, I said, "I think you'll understand your mum better if you do this picture." I think he got his back was up a bit when I said it to him, understandably, maybe crossed the line there. But when he started to make the music, he said, "Steve, you're absolutely right," because there were things in him that came out. I think it's one of Hans's best scores. I know it is. Because I sat with him shoulder to shoulder when he was doing the music, it came out of him. And if you hear the beginning, it's all recorders. It's like an orchestra of recorders, and it kind of as it sort of moves along, it sort of amalgamates to sort of orchestral. Basically, it's just more it's not in simplistic times, basically, but in some ways, it's about George's journey. George isn't the George at the end of the picture. As when he started the picture.
Because a lot of the score feels like it's almost a musical companion for George and his emotions.
Yeah, and also the actual the music that we hear in the, that Nicholas Brutel recorded, Oh Johnny, for example, in the Café de Paris. I mean, that was the actual song that was being played when the bomb dropped. That was the actual song being played. And it was a song about orgasm. It's about orgasm, isn't it? Oh Johnny, oh how cute, oh Johnny. And it's the ultimate high of life and the death. That was the song that was being played.
It's that whole scene is extraordinary. The kind of the track and shot. Mm. You know, apologize if my terminology is wrong.
Dude, I don't even know myself. Listen, let me tell you something. My best friend, he died, Robbie Muller, one of the best cinematographers. Robbie didn't know shit, but he knew to shoot. that's what macho shit. We ain't got time for that. But give me the camera. Does that work? No, give me that one. That works. Put it in. Shoot.
Let's not talk about it.
It's
let's
that
do
simple.
It.
Don't let anyone try to complicate anything for you. Just, you know, it works, it works. It don't work, it don't work. Give me something else.
Well, the way you shot it, it's brilliant. And just the movement of the camera, and Celeste is such the perfect choice for that performance as well. How did you literally just, I don't know, ask her? How did that happen?
How did I get Celeste?
How did you get Celeste?
I wanted to sing it. I'm asking myself, because I thought, goodness gracious, I thought this voice, I think it could have been Nicholas actually, because this weird, beautiful voice of, oh, Celeste, she sounds good. And that was it. She wanted to do it, and there was a bit of argy-bargy, but then we got her.
History with a Sade 1 minute, Celeste the next minute. You know, you can pull them in.
Yeah,
clearly.
And both of them, you know, not bloody easy, let me tell you. Bloody hell. Greta Garbo or pop, both of them.
But that shot, that scene, you know, in terms of the way that we hit silence and the way then it comes back into the Café de Paris after it's been bombed, but the way the score embraces the old Johnny.
Yes, Death March.
Whoa,
yeah, Death March. Yeah, I just wanted it to be Death March after boom, 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 boom. Yeah. And again, don't forget, it's life and death. With the highs of the highs of life, of course, what I told you about, obviously what the song's about, and actually what's going on in the club. We have Snake Hip Johnson, the conductor of that. That was a real guy. He was from Guyana, Snake Hip Johnson. He based himself on Duke Ellington. He was in Harlem, openly gay black man, living with a well-to-do white guy. You know, that you smelt the sexual appetite in the air because of any moment someone could die. You see what was going on. You know, I mean, there was, interestingly enough, in that club, there was a guy called Hutch. You know, he was a guy. He was Just a Gigolo. He was a pianist. Just a Gigolo was written about him. He was called Porter's. He was called Porter's guy. Yeah, I could tell you too many stories about that club. The club was wild. You know. Anyway, moving on. Yeah, he was from Grenada. In fact, Hutch. So it's much more interesting than you can't glaze over the Blitz. The Blitz was the first moment of reference. Forget the '60s. Come on, Quentin Crisp. People didn't give a. Excuse me. People didn't care if you were, you know, gay or straight. Then it's just get on with it. You know.
Yeah.
We didn't have television yet. People didn't understand. It was experimenting, finding out what felt good and what felt right. You know.
The other stunning scene. I mean, the film's just full of wonderful kind of almost like small short films within this film, is when Rita and Marcus are in the club, and the music in that is just fantastic as well. But the way that it's shot and just the energy of that scene, you know, as well, and that relationship that we get to see, a very fleeting moment of you know, of George's dad and their relationship. Yeah.
That was Nicholas Buteles again. Music was playing with him in New York. I mean, he was just amazing doing that. And again, the energy, of course, is shot very differently to Café Royal. Café de Paris, is much more. It's very swishy because this is much more raw, much more sort of funky, if you will, much more physical, much more sort of again on the drums. And who's on the drums? Femi from Ezra Collections on the drums.
No.
Oh yeah. London's here. London's here.
Yeah, because you feel like you're in amongst the feet of everybody, and you're kind of it's so
much
immersive,
more organic, visceral. The beat, the bam, dom, the bass. You know, it's really kind of something different. Yeah, of course, the movements are to a certain extent. There's a kind of a way of doing it, but it's very free in a way compared to Café Royal, which is very sort of ritualized.
Thank you. wanted to talk about specifically about the queue in it was when George is walking through the empty arcade. You know, he's looking in the shop fronts and looking back on his heritage, looking into his heritage through these windows. And in a way, and I wanted to talk to you about what you talk to Hans about for that specific, because there's no dialogue and it's the music is kind of really hitting emotion quite hard in that.
Well, what happened was it was Adam Stockhouse, my art director, and Adam Somner, my first AD, were in Hull doing a recce. I was doing something else. And then they saw this, they saw, oh, Steve, we found this arcade. It was like in Hull. What's this? Oh, arcade. And I thought, okay, what is it? Let me look at it. Mm. Okay. I thought, ah. Immediately I knew what to do. So I wrote a scene. I just wrote that scene about, you know, Empire Arcade. And what it is, it's the foundation of Britain. I mean, it's a foundation. One is talking about Hitler. One is talking about Nazis. One is talking about war. But there's other things going on in this country, which is the foundation of who one, you know, says they are. And, you know, one has to sort of represent that. You have to deal with that. You have to reflect on it. And George has to see that. And again, and that's when Ife taps him on the shoulder. And apparently this is a colonial, you know, within the context of now, and you know what has been perpetuated as far as, you know, so many things which one it was necessary to do in the sense of way of what it was, and it's based on actually those arcades, which, you know, some of those shop fronts were kind of real in a way that we just copied them, Empire goods. And the music again, it's a coming of age music. It's like, you know, when you're a filmmaker and then you go to Hollywood and you, oh my God, I made it in Hollywood, it's amazing. And you go behind the Hollywood sign, and oh, oh yeah, is that it? Okay, you know, but that's what it is. There's no gods. There's no gurus. It doesn't exist. You know, it's all make believe. Yeah.
It's Wizard of Oz.
It is that little person on the tricycle. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got some time for audience questions if anybody in the audience would like to oh, amazing, love that. I like the slow hand. It's like, don't be shy, just get it up there. And we've got another mic on this side if anybody else would. Hello, sir, what's your question?
I don't know if this is homework for us, but that Imak Bakia, I saw the credit for the 20s French film that you've interstitched the white flowers through, and curious if you could talk a bit about that or if we're supposed to go home and check it out ourselves.
So what I was interested in, the First World War and how avant-garde artists were dealing with the First World War. And again, in that time of cinema and abstraction, using cinema in a way to push images, to push art, to push narrative, to push something. And the whole idea of using film, it was, artists using it to work in an abstract way was kind of interesting, you know, to fragment and to find. Basically, this was all after the First World War. People were trying to deal with the First World War and trying to deal with the madness of it and what it meant. And I was doing some research on that, and I found this that movie. It was actually made by Man Ray, and I was looking at it, and there was this element of the sort of sea, the black and white images at the beginning. Because at first, of course, you don't know what that image is, the first image is, and that's obviously a reflection of the sea as the plane goes up. But the second image is a rock, X-ray images of salt rocks, which he did, and then it cuts into the daisies. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, I'm having that, I'm putting it in. But what it was about, because the flowers, in some ways, what it does is represent a certain kind of situation of how things were and how things could be. There's a kind of nostalgia, black and white daisies, of how things. It's kind of salvation, how things were and how things could be, as opposed to how things are. And I do believe, of course, you know, if we all have our hands on the steering wheel, we could turn things around. I'm not thinking that we can't. So those daisies, the black and white film, was a nostalgic image, but it was about how things were and how things could be. And again, we were talking about Marvin Gaye before. It is like, you know, Mercy, Mercy Me, or Imagine. There is a possibility, you know. If I thought if everything was done, I'd be jumping myself, taking myself to a bridge long time ago. You know what I mean?
Thank you for your question. Hello.
When you are going to shoot some complicated scenes like the water in the underground, what are some steps that you do to prepare for shooting a scene like that? And when you're shooting it, what are you focused on the most versus like how what other crew that are working and supporting you with your vision are doing?
Well, yeah, first of all, having some great people around you, but to have fun. I think that's the most important, to have fun. I mean, you know, ooh, what is it? Does it do that? Oh, can it do that? You put the camera. Well, look at that. That's amazing. Look, can we? Oh, yeah, no, that's not good. But what about that? Ooh, that kind of thing. I mean, I'm not. You know, like I said, you don't put. You know, if filmmakers are real, whatever in life. You know, don't put. You know, it's got to break. So you might as well have fun with it. I think the most important thing for me was that situation of the family. That was the. I'm not telling you a lie. The most important thing was the love between the family. That's why this movie is about love. First of all, ain't about some wicked scene or, oh, look at that hose. Look at that. Look at that. It was Cafe de Paris. It's about love. And then on top of that, you could do those things. So that's easy. And I mean that. I don't mean it in a flippant way. But yes, it is technically this, technically that. But if you're in the moment, you'll get it. You just focus on it and you'll get it and you have fun with it. That's it. Or just shoot it again. Then you get it. That other stuff you can't make up. You can't do. Once I had that, again, I'm going on in a way, because yes, and I enjoy obviously shooting. I enjoy it, but I just love to sort of be free doing it. That's all. I mean, again, I'll tell you a funny story. Then we were shooting. You know, there was Elliot waking up with the feather on the pillow,
mm-hmm.
and then get the macro lens out. Where's my macro lens? I said, I want the macro lens for the feather on the pillow. Where's my flipping macro lens? All right, get a bite. Get me a flipping macro lens. No, Steve, this one. No, don't. Give me a macro lens. 200 people waiting 2 hours, waiting out. Yeah, an hour and a half of macro lens. I don't care. Where's my macro lens? To shoot a feather on a pillow. True story. So that's the way you got to think about it.
Always have a macro lens. Hello.
So for a really heavy topic, I actually found this film quite accessible. I kind of felt like if I did watch this as myself as 12 or 13, I think I would have learned a lot, but I wouldn't have come away necessarily traumatized. It felt accessible. Is that because it was through the eyes of the young boy?
I think so. I think someone said to me, Steve, I think this is the movie I would love to have seen when I was a kid. And I think it is that, but also, you know, as an adult, you could see you do refocus your gaze in a way, and I think it becomes actually more heavier in a way, because you realize how much of idiots we are and how horrible we are, but at the same time, yes, how great we can be. I mean, you know, we had a situation in central London the other day with 20,000 fascists marching in the center of London. You know, we had a situation this summer, race riots, and we're talking about the same thing here. So I'm grateful that it is accessible in that way, because, you know, some things will fly over people's heads, some things you get, things. Again, I've always wanted to make something which goes beyond the frame. I've always wanted to make things which are sort of, okay, you know cinema goers or cinema, you know, people are interested in it. But again, if I'm not making something which is beyond the frame, there's no point in doing it. I mean, what we did with Hunger, we did 12 years and so forth and whatnot. It's very important for me because, you know, I just want to make some noise. I want to, again, at least try. You know, again, 5 minutes off the iPhone, and that's as much as I can ask for. That's my success rate.
I loved when we were actually sat outside and the door opened into the cinema and you could hear how the sound of the film in here, and it was almost like a childlike expression on your face at the kind of level of the noise, and you knew exactly what the moment was at the film. Mm. And just seeing how that flash that I got of excitement that you get of the kind of reaction to your film. You clearly love what you do. Just that moment of seeing you react to hearing it was just a wonderful insight into what it means to you to be a filmmaker, I guess.
Yeah, it's a privilege. I know I'm a very privileged person making films of this, so therefore I have to be useful. I don't think I've felt more useful than now at this time making this film, you know, when the whole world's on fire. You know, Gaza, Israel, Palestine, Sudan, Ukraine, and it's all about race. It's all about, all these wars about race. So, you know, we got to wake up. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, when people sort of, oh, yeah, I need to do something about race. Well, it's all about race. I mean, look around us.
Did you deliberately make the film about events and people and their situations then, but with it having a relevance to now?
I don't think I could have done it any other way, but it wasn't deliberate. You know, again, it, that's how it was in 1940. I mean, you know, again, I work with great historians. I mean, it wasn't trying to tick boxes or, you know what I do? Okay, this is it. I never attempt to put my stencil onto a subject matter. The subject matter has to tell me what it wants. I think that's, you know, my films are so-called different because I serve the subject. You know, the subject doesn't serve me. I'm not that interesting. I think the subject is it and how maybe I could elevate as be a vessel for it is much more interesting. So, you know, you think of Occupy City, you think of, I don't know, shame. They're very different because the subject is asking you for it to be what it needs to be, not the other way around.
The whole idea of making a film, there's almost three films that you make. You know, there's the film that you write, the film that you shoot, the film that you edit. Is that your journey, or are you a director who kind of, you go in and you know what you want, you shoot that, you don't have, there's nothing kind of really left on the editing floor, or what's your journey from
Well, I learned to shoot pictures because of a Super 8 camera. So these cartridges would be about £3.50, and then you rattle off, and that's 15 pence, bloody hell. So it'd be like, oh, I better learn how to do this, or what? No, I want as much as I can, but, you know, and therefore the economy of means made my craft because I didn't want to waste money because I couldn't, you know, afford it. So therefore, your craft is, oh, I love craft because, and therefore I don't do coverage. I don't do coverage because, you know, I don't want to waste. I don't tax my artists. I don't want to tax my crew. It's planned, but at the same time. There was always a surplus that you could get into because you've got to be, you know, I'm not one of these people who shoot 30 hours to cut down to 30 minutes. There's got to be a certain, and also your crew, you've got to respect your crew and their craft. They will give you the best from a limited situation. And actually also I think sort of limitation is freedom. You know, therefore there's less decisions to make.
I wanted just to give a shout out to Adam, your production designer as well. In terms of the world that you created, you know, and how much of, you know, what was the reality of where you shot the film? You know, you mentioned Hull, and did you have the luxury of, or what is a luxury? Is a luxury being on a close set where you're under more control of things, or is it a combination of many things?
Well, a combination of the two. Adam Stockhausen, Norman Sumner was an amazing first AD, I keep on saying his name. Adam Stockhausen is extraordinary. I worked with him for the last 12 years. For example, the subway, the underground, and the slight beautiful curve in the underground. So we shot in Leesden, and there happened to be a pop up studio in Leesden. So we actually built that in there, and it was curved, it was scaffolded, and the engineering feat of pumping water in there, and regurgitated this whole system, this ecolic system was extraordinary. And Adam designed that. And again, you know, holding the water, gallons and tons of gallons of water. And then to go up. And then we did a second stage, which was where the gates were. So this whole, you know, this system was pretty incredible. And again, obviously the dragging people down the tunnel and whatnot. So, you know, it was pretty extraordinary. And, you know, again, also, it's interesting about the Café de Paris and other sort of sets. It's as much as you have to build them, it's an art to sort of to smash them up. You know? No. So Adam was extraordinary, again. And also, when we did the factory, for example, that was in Liverpool. So, you know, and lots of things were made there. And, it was just, again, I wanted not to do things behind it with a green screen or blue screen. I wanted to find things for real. So, you know, went to certain places, you know, the place that, you know, that were neglected, you know, in the UK, which unfortunately there are few. So went there.
You mentioned the factory, and I just wanted, one of the things that I love about the film that it celebrates is the women of that time. And yeah, just how important they were. And yeah, and it's, again, it feels like it's not that side of it. And also just how, you know, like Hayley Squires' character, they're all just brilliant. And they all are telling little moments of different situations of those women of that time. You know, there could easily be a film of all of those women as the lead, you know, in terms of their story, because you feel the depth in what they've got to say.
Absolutely, because every single character in the picture, you could go off with them, but that was all in the slice of life. And that's what war does, it cuts you off, you move through. I mean, the women, they were the emotional backbone, and physical backbone of the country. I mean, they held the stuff. They were looking after elderly parents, taking their children off to be evacuated, working in ammunition factories, working in aircraft hangars, you know, keeping the home together. And then when the guys came back with the PTSD, you know, post-stress disorder, you know, they were holding that together too. I mean, the fact that normally in movies, what you see with women, what are they? They're mattresses, forgive me, they're girlfriends, hysterical women, or handing someone like a cup of tea, when really what they were doing was doing the real work of holding the country together, and they'd been not unappreciated. I mean, you know, this is half of the story of the war effort, and it's been sort of minimalized to hysterical women or some kind of love interest who just get in the way. And it's just, yeah, well, and then you understand, it's like, you know, it's like cowboys and Indians, isn't it? It's like, then you realize that the whole makeup of the Blitz in some ways, particularly that situation, and also the ethnic dynamic of London, is like cowboys and Indians, and you find that Native Americans aren't the bad guys. So again, it's important, one puts this in film, important that we talk about this, and talk, but also important that we sort of, this becomes a mirror on who and reflecting who we actually are, rather than who we think we are.
Thank you so much. Thank you. For your time tonight. It's been
first and foremost, I just wanted to make an exciting movie as well. That's the key to this. Again, it's just, you know, it's not a history lesson. Far from it. It's an emotional roller coaster with this child going through London. That's the important thing. But at the same time, you can't neglect the environment that this happened in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for letting me pick your brain and talk about it.
Okay.
And thank you for being here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. It's so great to have you, Steve McQueen, everybody.
From The Score to Blitz, that's Lost Property, Not Lost Children by Hans Zimmer, rounding off this latest soundtrack in Everyman Film Club with the wonderful Steve McQueen. Now, we mentioned Nick Britell there, so I just wanted to play you a little clip from episode 46 of our podcast, just one of the episodes that Nicholas has featured on, when he recalled what it was like to work with Steve on 12 Years a Slave.
Some of the music was used in 12 Years a Slave as well, Steve McQueen's film as well, which is a wonderful film.
That was an incredible opportunity, working with Steve McQueen. I mean, he's unbelievable. You know, I was so honored to get that chance to collaborate with him, and I wrote and researched and arranged the on-camera music in the film, so I worked on the musical performances, the violin performances, the dances, the spiritual, the field songs, so worked all very closely with Steve on all of that.
Yeah. It's like almost being given an assignment in a way.
And it was fascinating too, because I think, you know, one of the amazing things, it was the 1840s for 12 Years a Slave, and there are no recordings from the 1840s. So in addition to doing the research and figuring out what would people likely have played, you know, what would an African-American violinist have played in New York State in 1841...
Thank you.
That's one question. And then what is the sound of this music too? You know, what is the sound of music in the South in the 1840s? And those are the questions where we would do a huge amount of research, but then we would also say to ourselves, well, at a certain point, there's an element of artistic reimagining too, because we literally will never actually know what did that violin sound like or what did those singers sound like. So that was the exciting thing too. And I think Steve and I were able to come to a place where, again, you know, it felt like it was part of the texture of the film.
Yeah.
And Steve has incredible instincts. You know, he would guide me with things, and when things were right, he immediately would know.
Nicholas Britell there discussing the work on 12 Years a Slave from episode 46 of Soundtrackin'.
Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service, because nobody likes waiting around. You listen in, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
My huge thanks to Steve for taking the time to talk to us, for all the reps on his side for making that possible, and for the good folk at Everyman for accommodating us so hospitably. Blitz is in selected cinemas now before premiering on Apple TV on the 22nd of November. You know what I'm going to say though, get along to see it on the big screen if you can. Head to edithbowman.com to hear my previous chats with Steve, Nicholas and indeed Hans Zimmer. Soundtrack in UK is also the place that you can find us on your socials. And we have a YouTube channel called Soundtrack and Extra, which we'd really appreciate you subscribing to. We've got loads of great content up there. Next up, it was a joy to spend time with the wonderful Malcolm Washington, son of Denzel, to discuss his debut feature film, The Piano Lesson. So I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.